Mehta, Chairperson Coalition Committee. Members, if you can introduce yourselves, and then Minister and the Department HOD will ask you to introduce yourselves and all the guests at the back to introduce yourselves. Thanks.
Thank you, Voorzitter. Goeiemôre, Dylan Mitchell.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Basil Cavido, alternate member.
Good morning, everybody. The Reverend Dorothea Kaupi, member of this committee.
Good morning. My name is Polisa Makeleni.
Good morning. My name is Pat Lecker.
Morning. Noma French and Bopo.
Good morning, Leslie Shant, Information Management.
Good morning, Beth Engelbrecht, Head of the Health Department.
Good morning, Krish Balabji, Strategy and Health Support.
Good morning, David Pinar, Rural Health Services.
Hi, good morning, Laura Angeliti Dutwe, Infrastructure.
Good morning, I'm Douglas Newman Valentine, Head of Ministry.
Good morning, I'm Tato Masidi, Public Health Registrar and Metro Health Services.
Good morning, Riyad Adamson from PMG.
Good morning, my name is Tiana Murray and I'm a researcher.
Thank you very much and good morning to the language practitioners at the back and then to Namonde Yamka, just on my left, who is our coordinator, and Mary Ann Burgess, who is the assistant coordinator. With the department, we are here for the quarterly performance reports for two quarters, and we are not going to have a presentation, right? We are going to have the presentation as on the pages in front of us. You're going to go through it like that. Okay, if it comes up, it comes up. Otherwise, we have the presentations in front of us, and we have received it timeously. So I will give then over to the department to go through the presentations, and after that we'll pose the questions.
So I think it's difficult to say a few words for because I think our mind now is on the second quarter, because we're in the middle of the second quarter of the new financial year. Now we're talking about something that happened in October until March. So that's why for me it's about just taking the question. Because we might be saying, we might be asking, why didn't blah blah blah, and then we said we have corrected anyway for now. So that's why I think I'll just keep quiet.
Thank you, Chairperson. The presentation, you would notice I've got quarter three and then quarter four and then annual. And there might be questions in quarter three that are being answered in the annual. So perhaps with your permission, we could go through the presentation and then focus on the annual. So as a few introductory points from my perspective, you would notice that the health department in our annual performance plan have a total of 150 indicators, of which there were 15 new indicators developed by the National Department of Health, which usually has an impact on developing systems, and very often it comes so late, it's the day before you submit, and then it has an impact on your ability to set proper targets, but also how to ultimately have the systems for data collection. So I just want to put that out as an introduction, and then Ms. Shand will then take us through the presentation as was distributed, and together with the document was also then an Excel spreadsheet. My recommendation to the Secretariat would be to, if possible, print it out in an A3 format for the honourable members, because it is small, and we had to give all the quarters so that the honourable members could see the flow during the year. But that would be my recommendation. Thank you, Chair.
Members, just an omission from my side to this meeting. I have received apologies for two members, members McKenzie and member Gillian. Member Cavido is standing in for member McKenzie. So I have received that apology. Thank you, Mashan. Mm-hmm.
So as the HOD has said, the presentation is divided up into quarter three, quarter four, and then the annual. The quarter three and quarter four, I've really just listed those indicators where we have not achieved or partially achieved and gone into the detail and under the annual report. So if you look at quarter three, you can see that we had on the first slide a 119 indicators that were relevant during that quarter, and 81% of those were achieved, with five being not achieved and 18 being partially achieved. EMS and Health Facilities Management are the two programs where we are underperforming on more indicators than we are achieving, whereas in administration we are achieving all of our indicators. Yeah, the numbers in those departments are very small, so you can see that Health Facilities Management and Emergency together only had 7 indicators, whereas our biggest group of indicators is sitting in District Health Services, Provincial Hospital Services, and Central Hospital Services, and there we are reaching up around about 80-90% of our targets there. So in quarter three, Chair, if you'd like me to go through each one can I focus on the annual performance? So then I'm going to just skip it through.
So I thought when there was an apology on the size of the presentation, I thought that by saying at least whatever is important for us to know, at least to mention that, because I really struggled to read this report. So if they can just, whatever they think is important for us to know.
If you can go to slide 8. The heading is 2017-18 annual indicator performance versus APP target.
Which one?
So you can see that, as Dr. Engelbrecht said, we have 150 indicators for the year on our annual performance plan. 121 of those were achieved, with 27 being partially achieved and 2 being not achieved, which ends up being 81% of our targets being achieved. Focus, I think, is probably on program 2, and we'll go through the indicators that we achieved and not achieved there, and then look at some of the others in the other programs. So the next slide, I'm looking at the highlights and the achievements for the year, and I just thought I'd lift out some of the indicators where we've achieved well for the department. So some of them are things like the cultural entropy level has improved in the department. We received an unqualified audit for the year. And then we've also managed to implement or roll out broadband access to more than 90% of our facilities. That's across primary healthcare and hospitals. In terms of quality assurance, more than 80% of our hospitals have achieved more than 75% on the compliance with the national core standards, and complaints that we've received, 90% to 98% of those have been resolved, with 93% actually being resolved within 25 working days. Looking at ideal clinic status, 89% of our fixed facilities conducted an ideal clinic status determination. The indicator for this year was not looking at how well they did, but really looking at whether we did determination or not. In terms of our hospitals, on average our hospitals are 86% occupied, and the norm really is about 85%, so most of our hospitals are actually not higher than that, or some of them are not higher than that. And the average length of stay, the target set, we were within 5% of the target across the board. In terms of our expenditure per patient day equivalent, in all of our programs, we were within target for the year. And then the primary healthcare utilization rate was also within target at 2.2 for the year. Maternal mortality rate was lower than last year, and our antenatal visits before 20 weeks was above target. In terms of our TB infection, drug sensitive and MDR treatment success rates was above target. And then clients remaining on ART and antenatal plans started on ART were also above target. We tested patients for HIV a lot more than what we actually targeted for. And then in terms of children, our immunizations are generally above target for the year. There are some that are just slightly below, but most of them are above, either on target or above. And then in terms of bursaries and interns, generally we are above target, and I'll deal with the two that were below target in the next slide. So the next slide, we're looking at underperformance in Program 2, which is your district health services. The one indicator where we didn't achieve there was severe acute malnutrition case fatality rate. And the reason we didn't achieve there, there's a couple of reasons. The one is that the number of cases admitted actually halved, but the acuity of the patients admitted increased, resulting in 10 deaths. And this then increased our fatality rate. The second issue is that our target was set based on a previous definition. So in the past, they only looked at patients whose primary diagnosis was malnutrition, and this year they started looking at all patients who were malnourished, irrespective of what your primary diagnosis was. So you may have had diarrhea and malnutrition, or TB and malnutrition. And our target was set based on our baseline of the previous year, so it was difficult to set that target, resulting in an increase there. Then in Program 2, the partially achieved, we had 14 partially achieved. The retention in care for ART patients for 12 months and 48 months was only partially achieved. And this is basically due to the social conditions and economic influences on the more vulnerable population, which has an impact on the retention in care. So it's very difficult to get permanent addresses and accurate contact information of these patients to try and track them and keep them in care when they don't come for their visits. In terms of medical male circumcision, we've actually improved compared to last year, but we're still below target, and the improvements can really be attributed to the assistance of non-profit organizations that we've used to assist us here. And those partnerships are hopefully going to be strengthened and continued going forward. But the societal influences and stigmas attached to this impact on how well we can do. In terms of TB, the three indicators there that we've partially achieved are affected really by socioeconomic status and substance abuse within the community. Approximately one third of our TB patients are also HIV positive, which places them at a much higher risk of death due to TB, even if they are on ART. So for this year, we're looking at developing more responsive electronic tools that can help us track patients and also identify those that are at risk earlier on, so that we can engage with them at best. The next slide. Our mother postnatal visit within 6 days rate. Really the reason here is that mothers don't always return for care, or they return after 6 days. So the definition is quite strict to say that the postnatal visit has to happen within 6 days of birth, and sometimes that might fall on a Saturday or a Sunday, or the mom just can't come on the 6th day, so she comes on the 7th, and we can't count it there. In terms of diarrhea and pneumonia, both of those, the fatality rates were higher than we had targeted, and this is mainly due to the nature of these indicators the number of deaths cannot be predicted with 100% accuracy. However, there was a decline in the number of admissions we actually had to the hospitals, which also then impacted on the outcome of this indicator. And we're seeing the decrease in admissions actually as a positive outcome. Then school grade 1 learners screened, and also the HPV first dose, we underperformed slightly on these two indicators, and it was mainly due to ad hoc campaigns that were introduced during the year to deal with things like measles. And the staff that would normally have done the school health visits or the HPV campaign were diverted to assist with the ad hoc campaigns that were needed. Cataract surgery rate slightly underperformed. And the underperformance can be attributed mainly to equipment shortages and staff shortages due to a certain point of the year, and that resulted in underperformance. Services are going to be reviewing plans to address this going forward so that we can meet our target. In terms of deliveries in our 10 to 19 year old age groups and also the neonatal deaths, the definition for both of these indicators changed for this. It is on the slide, so it is up on the board if you want to follow. It is under the soft. Sounds very loud in my ears. The definition for both of these indicators has changed this year, and so our target was based on the previous definition. Deliveries for 10 to 19 years used to be 10 to 18 years, and just that increase of 1 year in the definition actually pushed the number of deliveries up in that age group. And then our neonatal death rate, previously we were looking at the early neonate, which is 0 to 7 days, and this year the indicator was looking at 0 to 28 days, so that was also a change in the definition which impacted on our targets and our performance. Then in program 8 we had an not achieved indicator, the percentage of program 8 health technology budget spend. The over expenditure can be attributed to health technology equipment expenditure, additional project allocations were made to mitigate projected under expenditure in infrastructure. There were also occasional changes to expenditure time frames as a result of either earlier or later practical completion of projects. And then we also had under expenditure on maintenance and capital infrastructure, which then balanced out this over expenditure that we had on the technology budget. Overall, however, we had an under expenditure of $53 million on the program. And then the partially achieved indicators for programs 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. In EMS, we had three indicators which were partially achieved. And generally, our response rates for urban response under 15 minutes was due to things like prolonged staff ill health, which included post-traumatic stress disorders from increased attacks on EMS staff over the recent months. And that also tended to reduce our capacity to deliver services. Our interfacility transfer rates and EMS emergency cases were affected by the red zones as a result of the attack. And because of these areas being classified as red zones, we have to wait for SAPS escorts to take the staff into the areas, which also then delays our response time. And then the third thing which impacted on our EMS indicators was that the definition changed this year to exclude obstetric cases, so that had an impact on our performance. And then in terms of, there were a couple of indicators in the our specialized hospitals, hospital bed utilization rate in TB hospitals was slightly below target, and this was mainly due to a policy of decentralizing TB management of patients, which resulted in them having a shorter length of stay in our hospital. And that also impacted on the expenditure of the PDE for TB hospitals. In our rehab hospitals, one of our indicators measures whether we have mortality and morbidity meetings on a monthly basis. We had targeted to have 12 for the year, but in December we didn't have sufficient management staff available to hold a meeting with a full quorum, and so that was postponed to January, where those mobility and mortality issues were dealt with in the January meeting. The average length of stay at Tigerberg Hospital was slightly longer than anticipated, and that was due to patients in the ICU high care and psychiatric and spinal units staying longer than anticipated due to the acuity of the care. Then in program 6, the number of bursaries that were awarded for SCES and critical skills categories was slightly below target, and this is mainly due to students who either did not meet the minimum entry requirements for the HEIs. We had some failures of the students, and then also funding use, and then partly we had to use funding to fund relief staff so staff could go on training. So we couldn't actually award all the bursaries. And then assistant interns for forensic pathology services. This is an ongoing problem. We have difficulty recruiting appropriate interns due to the entrance requirements and the nature of the work within forensic pathology. And then the last three relate to Program 8. I've touched on them briefly, but the percentage reduction in energy consumption in provincial hospitals, we didn't quite meet the target there. And I think with the drought this year, the focus tended to be more on the water than on the on saving electricity. And then the capital infrastructure expenditure and maintenance budget spent in Program 8 was as a result of delays in appointment of the professional service providers and contracts. Poor performance of the contractors, slow performance of the PSPs, long lead times for stage deliveries, and also delays in the finalization of our finance accounts. And that is basically the indicators and how we've performed against them.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and thanks to Ms. Shang for putting it out. So it's always interesting that we focus on what we've not achieved, but there's such a lot that we have achieved. And very often also, if one compares a target or an achievement compared to the previous year, it tells a different story. But let us hear what the questions are, and then we can give that context in the responses as well. Thank you.
Member Mitchell, Member Lekas.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to get my bearings. Chair, firstly, let me welcome the presentation. I think in that last sentence by the HOD, you summed it up. We always focus on the perceived negativity, and especially in light of the fact that we are on the ground in our community, so we only hear about the complaints. Nobody calls us as politicians to say, oh, brilliant service received at Maritzburg or in Nelspoort or in both ways. But Chair, I want to, under medical male circumcision, the non-profit organizations being used by the department, is it possible that we could perhaps get a list? And I'm particularly interested in the Central Karoo Eden District, if I could get a list of that. I mean, you don't have to give it to me now, but if we could at the end. And then, Chair, just a last thing, with regards to the cataract surgery rate, we were fortunate to do an oversight visit at Malmesbury Swartland Hospital, and what we saw there was amazing. Friedendal Hospital, sorry. It was an amazing setup, and it was for everything that's bad about the perceived perception. I mean, it was a beautiful environment. So I just want to find out where are those certain points that you referred to that there's a backlog, for the lack of a better word. And I know that for Mandela Day, the department and under Minister Mbombo, that was the focus. So did that help to reduce that that underperformance? And then with regards to the forensic pathology services, we went and did an oversight visit at the forensic in Salt River. And obviously the need and demand is there for more staff. And then they explained to us, and maybe you can shed some light, about some agreement with I think it was CPUT, to try and get us some sort of course to, and there was an issue with funding, for the officers, yes, for training. So what currently happened, so we were informed, that all these forensic pathologists or scientists rather go to Australia, I think is the word, is the country that they directly mentioned, because of the workload becoming so enormous and they can't keep up. So what's the status with that relationship between CPUT and the department to try and see if we can alleviate some sort of the burden on the staff? Yeah, that's all for me. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Member Lekker.
Thank you, Chair. My first question is on page 3 of this booklet. And that would be, Chair, in terms of the ideal clinic status determination, it seems that there are reasons which caused this particular thing for not to be achieved, and I want to check how many of those clinics were conducted in terms of the status determination, and what was the actual total which was supposed to have been done. The second one, Chair, is perhaps I need to get clarity. When you go further down to partially achieved, the economic status as one of the reasons seems to be a popular response as to why it has not been partially achieved. And I want to understand exactly what do the department mean. Can they unpack those reasons to get clearer reasons instead of just the word which is ambiguous economic status to me? And the third one, Chair, is on the 90% broadband. And I want to understand exactly. Because when we were at the Friedendahl Hospital, I noticed that they were still using the manual operations in terms of filing. And when I asked the doctor, he said, they don't have enough staff to do these things electronically. And I want to check, is the department making any efforts in addressing that? Because that was a direct response that I got when I inquired about it. The last one, Chair, is on, I think it's the very last page, on FPS in 10. And my concern there, Chair, is if the problem seems to be that students don't meet the minimum requirements, is there an effort to do an outreach to these institutions? During the orientation, there's an outreach conducted to establish exactly if there are people who are interested in enrolling in this kind of subject, because my main concern, if you go to Tiger Beg Mortuary, you find a different story than it was at Salt River. It's extremely bad. I was there 2 weeks ago. It's bad, and I want to understand to what extent is the department reaching out in order to address this problem. Because if it's not addressed, we're not only going to experience the issues of Muslims' bodies that are in a backlog, but rather all religions will be confronted with the same situation, that their bodies, they are unable to conduct PM on those bodies. So it's very serious, and can we just get some seriousness in terms of attending to these issues, make students interested in enrolling in this kind of subject. Thank you.
Thank you. Member Makalini.
Thank you, Chair. And the question will start on page 3 on the pneumonia case fatality rate. I'd like the department to explain to me exactly what is going on here. Moving further, Chair, to page 9. On page 9, there is an 86% average occupancy rate. Maybe here, Chair, I just need, it might not be responded to today, but I need a list of the hospitals that have over 100 bed occupancy, and if the department can also give us what would be the plan going forward for those hospitals who have the bed occupancy that is 100 and more. Again, on page 9, there's a question on maternal mortality rate that is lower than last year. And then the reason there was that it changed from 0 to 7 days to 0 to 28 days. But I need to understand first, what is the exact figure? We are talking about the figure now. Né? And then secondly, what is it that they were trying to achieve by changing the number of days between 0 to 28. I think that was the explanation. And if you can also have an understanding of what then therefore is the impact on the service. It's explained nicely on page 11, right at the bottom. Okay, and if I go to page 10, we're talking about the severe acute malnutrition case fatality rate. Here also, Chair, I need to know if there was a focus on this and which areas did we see the trend, if there are any, but if they can give me an idea of where do we get this problem a lot. Again, on the issue of the ART retention, we always get this response, Chair, that the social conditions and economic conditions makes it difficult for the department to keep or treat the patient. But I need to understand, it can't be all these years we're still getting this, but maybe what is the plan going forward to tackle this, because my worry is TB. Yeah, yes, Olela. On page 12, I need a further explanation on the expenditure on the PPE hospital. Why was it partially achieved? And then on the next page, on the percentage of Program 8 capital infrastructure, I don't have an idea here, Chair, of what we are talking about and how severe this is. So maybe again, maybe not today, but if the department can also send us a list of where was this partially achieved so that we can be able to make our own assessment. I think I will end there, Chair. Oh, on the meeting that was supposed to be held in December, I'm just curious to know what is it that meeting would have done that could not be done outside that meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. Member Cavito.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you very much for the presentation. That clarified quite a lot of issues in my head. On page 10, the malnutrition issue. I'm looking at the causality factor. In terms of malnutrition, it's also been, not that it's been taken out of context, but seen as a specific one-dimensional disease or illness, but now the prevalence of malnutrition with diarrhea and also tuberculosis. I would like to know how this match is being diagnosed, how prevalent in terms of the prevalence and also in terms of the curative measures. I'm not sure whether the one leads to the other one, diarrhea leads to malnutrition or vice versa, or TB to malnutrition or vice versa, but you as the experts will know, but I'm just curious about that one. Then the medical male circumcision, with a side note that societal influence and stigma is sort of impeding this process. I see medical male circumcision as a pure clinical exercise, a conventional medical procedure, and why then the societal influences and stigma to a medical procedure that is being executed, and especially to enhance health and that is really in favor of the recipient or the patient itself, the client. So that one I would like to have clarified. And then I have another one, the last one I think, yes. This electronic tool, responsive electronic tool, where it comes to HIV AIDS or TB patients that are prone to contract HIV AIDS. Now this electronic tool, is it sort of that it can be preemptive, that it can preempt that HIV AIDS will follow, or there are certain indicators that point to that, that a person with tuberculosis is susceptible to HIV AIDS and that it can be rescued at an early stage by implementing this tool. I think this is really moving in the wonderful, correct route and direction to develop this tool, and also when do you intend introducing this tool? Because I think it will definitely, as I see it from where I'm sitting, will really help in the situation as far as HIV AIDS and TB is concerned. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you.
Chair, I've only got two because most are being has been covered. I've only got two, and mine is on page 12, on the understanding, the expenditure of 53 million since I came into the standing committee. This has been year after year the same problem. Now my question is, has the department done a research, what is the problem that makes the infrastructure resulting to underspending? Because this has been coming on for years. Has there research been done, and is there any solution to this not happening or occurring every year? And then also need more explanation on the average length of stay in Tigerberg and the ICU, because when you visit that hospital, that ICU is really a problem. I mean, the overcrowding that is taking place there, people being on the chairs for days and so on. Yeah, I just need more explanation. How are we going to address that issue at Tigerberg?
Thank you very much. HOD, as you have alluded, and the Minister, I think when we started, that the reporting is after the fact. So, and your response would now be what has happened in this window going forward. And I'm just thinking now that when you report again on quarter three and four, this committee would not look the way it looks now. It would be totally different then, when you are going to report back. But please just indicate as to what, how different it would look when you are going to report, because you have now, you know, this has evolved and developed after you have, after we have these facts in front of us. And I would also like to ask Dr. Tetuay Angelotti about, I remember when we were at Swartland Hospital, we also spoke about the relationship between your implementing department, which is Public Works and Transport, and how the relationship has gone in terms of what the relationship was before. And on Member Gopi's question, I'd also like to ask if you can, you know, talk to that too, if possible. Thanks, Dr. And Minister, are you, who would respond to all the questions posed?
I'm not responding to the actual progress related to the indicators. I'm just putting the policy, the comments, and some of these just for explanation. So I'm just keeping taking those that are relevant. Okay, with the issue of the cataracts, also we need to understand that I think they'll respond in terms of the tools and so forth, the staffing. But now, officially, we the diabetes is the major cause of death, because we've got patients who live longer, the life, I mean, people in the Western Cape, because of the life expectancy, and there is the diabetes. Know that one of the complications of the diabetes affects the eyes. Older. Other than that, the issue of the cataract, as you grow older, you still have your eyes need to be fixed, irrespective of whether you've got diabetes or not. But what I'm trying to highlight is that with the existing waiting list, irrespective, but now we have, like the diabetes, as one of the major cause of death, we will see many patients, I mean, people who suffer from diabetes, we will see many patients who might need for the cataracts. So hence we'll find that we'll never be able to close the tap around that. Hence we rely, as we have engaged with the Mandela 100, with a private assistance. Although it's a quick, because people have just done it and we go, and then they come again after 6 months or so to another eye. But it can be time consuming. And also what you didn't see was you mentioned Freerendal, where we have got the eye clinic. everybody. There are many of those that are happening in Eastern Sphere through the MJC as well, for example, through funding and so forth. Now, with the forensic pathology, it links up to the FPS in terms where you indicated, Honorable Member, like about how to be able to attract leads. We have got the forensic as a medical specialization. So after your 10 years as a doctor, inclusive of your normal internship and comp-serve, I put in 10 years, and then that is basic. And then you go for the specialization as a registrar, which can take about an average of 4 years. Now, depending, you are in the part of the program of the specialization, like Professor Lona Martin and Professor whatever in the Tiger Stellenbosch. So it's a medical specialization. So first, you need people to be interested to undergo that specialization. What we go to do the dead body is where you work in the public for the rest of your life. Because the FBI, they don't work private. They work within in terms of the undergoing part of the legal aspect of the investigation. Instead of going to be a pediatrician, going to be an obstetrician or orthopedic, something like that. So first of all, you've got that in terms of the interest. Secondly, it's about that kind of a specialization. It will take someone who probably will love even anatomy and the physiology and so forth. And also lastly, it means as any registrar, you need to be, you might have the post, but in terms of the supervision or even because the people are studying, for the professor to be able to have money in terms of putting the program, because that's what happens with the postgraduate. So it's not only about taking anyone from the streets and make the person to be a forensic pathology specialist. Now, the ones that you are talking about, the CPUT, FPO officer, long time ago, when this service was moved from the SAPS to Department of Health, all those people, they were not necessarily trained on anything. It was based on the experience. That's why there was something like where people used to be, like I used to be a cleaner in the police, and then I ended up developing an interest, and then I ended up being an FPO and so forth. But now, when they end up being part of us, that's where now we have to professionalize. At the time that there were strikes, if you recall, it was indicated that it's only the Western Cape where they managed to have a formalized kind of a structure, even have a directorate, like a director, in terms of the directorate of such. And then the Health Professional Council were supposed to endorse or credit a qualification, which now HA Health Professional Council is under the National Health Leadership, which is they didn't. It has been sitting there quite a while. So whilst for us, we ended up having some of these smaller and others training on the job, and also with the university, because it's a university course, to get some of those so that people have like a four-year degree. I think the proposal was about the four-year degree, whether it's a B.Tech and so forth, which Professor Martin and the other professors were busy with. So the issue is about where the program needs to be vetted by the Health Professional Council, which is supposed to be at the national level. They've been tracking about the issue of where now the other universities at that level, it might not necessarily be part of the medical school, but the CPUT, for example, UWC, because they're the ones who are doing the health sciences allied. They could do that. But it's among themselves. It has got nothing to do with us, but it needs to be approval by the academic fraternity before, for us, it's just to create that environment. But also, it doesn't mean that those who are already FPOs, they are not part of the training, which is we use our own, that they are doing. I've answered that part of it. You mentioned about the records and also in terms of electronic. In terms of the legislation, national legislation, you still have to keep the records, I think for minimum of 5 years, hard copies. So even if we might be going electronic in terms of some of them through the content management, but you still have to keep the file, so we have to do both. So, but in the advancement, it's about where you can do through the e-vision, where you can do that electronic discharge
or something like that, but you still have to keep those everywhere, even anywhere, you have to keep them. But the issue with the Fredendal, it was, it's true, it was about the network, which is, I think they couldn't respond around the board. The last time I was there, also there was about the network where they have to also work together with not only us, with the people who are dealing with the network. Okay, I'll leave the stage fatality. And then the other thing is about the bed occupancy versus also a average length of stay. These are the part of the international actual indicators, not necessarily national, part of international indicators where they define the quality of care. And it's according also to the type or the level of the hospital. Level one hospital, there's an expectation in terms of the beds. Level two and level three, and also in terms of the length of stay. For example, for a person who goes to level three, like a Tigerberg, that person is a highly specialized, so it's expected that the person might stay longer. And then the more you are coming from far, as for example, in Nelspoort, to discharge that patient quickly to Nelspoort, where the next specialization will be in George, you rather keep the patient here, it might take longer. Compared to the patient who might have been referred, let's say, from Kailicha, where they'll do that quick intervention at a high specialized level, Tigerberg, and then refer back to Kailicha, whether again for the readmission there, or that in your next follow-up, just go ahead and visit the Kailicha, so there's that difference. So in terms of which beds, in terms of occupancy, the metro district level hospitals, where like Kailicha, I think we're running around 130% at the time, they held a bag also over, it was 120% at the time. Still refill, it was also more. And then also in others, it might be in a certain service. So you might have a high occupancy, I mean a bed occupancy general for the whole overall hospital like Kailicha held a bag. But you might have the cases where it might be where during that time, if it's a quality season, the maternity is 120% occupied, but you find that probably in the male medical, it might be probably 80%, it depends, like when you want to zoom. For example, it will be expected around the December in the long holidays because of the interpersonal injuries and so forth, violence, you might get a high occupancy rate generally across. So that's why sometimes people say that, you say the bed is full, but when I went to visiting my mom at whatever, but I saw empty beds. But it's because those beds might be male beds, or it might be female beds, or it might be maternity beds, or it might be pediatric beds, where you cannot put other adults. But generally, level one, this is hospitals in the metro, like West Freer, Victoria, False Bay. And then with the average length of stays, as I've explained, where you'll have the average weight, say, at the six and a half to 8 days, or 3.5 to 4 days, it depends. But generally, with the current research that was done by the National Department of Health, they found that actually with the Western Cape hospitals, all these levels, they've seen a steep higher, a peak of going up of the occupancy, bed occupancy, which is all of the hours are more than 80%. Ideally, when it says 80%, it means it's full internationally, but we go above that because you are accounting even those that are sitting there. But the fact that we're going up compared to, let's say, in KZN, their level three hospitals go down, of course, because of the oncology and so forth. So that's where we are. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. You've covered good ground. I would like to fill in just a few aspects related to the questions. The first one was on the cataract surgery. The Minister has answered that, and thank you for the feedback on Fredendal. We're also very proud of that unit. We do have backlogs, and we set our targets according to the World Health Organization Vision 2020 standards. And we try to achieve that. So we do have waiting lists, and the waiting lists are at Groenskier, at Tigerberg, at Yester River, etc. So the waiting lists are there. And the question was, to what extent did the Mandela Day last year and this year assist it? So last year we did 40 cataract surgery cases. This year we did 95. as part of the Mandela Day project. The key limitation is you need to have, on the one hand, you need to have an ophthalmologist, you need to have a surgeon who can do the operations, and obviously a theater and anesthetist, and then also a particular microscope. So what we've done in both Fietendal and Eerste Rivier Hospital is to have high volume extract theaters. So in Eerste Rivier, for example, the same in Fietendal, it's the same surgeon that works at both. They do up to 40 cases a day. Well, that is really pushing it. But it just shows what can be done. What we also plan is that when we develop regional hospitals going forward, that we have all of these high volume extraction units in those hospitals as well. We are working with our central hospitals to achieve that type of level as well. But it is an aspect, and as the minister has rightly said, the underlying cause very often, apart from, you know, what people say, age, diabetes is the biggest problem. So if we can prevent diabetes, if we can properly treat diabetes and pick it up early, it might stand us in good stead and help us to curb the wave of a need for cataract surgery. On the forensic pathology services, the minister has answered the issue of what's the difference between a forensic pathology specialist and a forensic pathology officer. A particular comment in this document talks about the forensic pathology assistant intern. And it's important to note the entry requirements are such that you can provide a career path for that person to ultimately get a diploma. And the entry requirement is math, biology, science, English, or as a minimum entry requirement. So they're quite steep. So it depends on how the child selects subjects in school. That person will be able to make the choice to become a forensic pathology officer or not. And they enter through the intern process. And obviously the work environment in forensic pathology is not something that's up everybody's sleeve. So we do find, we really go out to recruit, we advertise, we get, and very often people apply, but when they see the work environment, they withdraw. So it is a challenge to us, but the minister has answered the question of the relation between us and CPUT. So CPUT does the diploma training. It's not a money issue, it's a diploma training program. They clearly have to develop the curriculum, go through the CTARs and all of those things. The funding comes for the specialists and the registrars. That is the reality, and the workload is heavy. The workload in the Western Cape is nearly double the national and international standard. So we recognize that. We've given additional two registrars funding, six additional forensic pathology officers and a medical officer in addition to what there has been. But ultimately we also realize, where do these cases come from? They come from violence in our communities. They come from unnatural deaths due to motor vehicle accidents. So it's, again, if we can put our focus on communities where violence doesn't lead to death, like the unnatural death, or the motor vehicle accident. So all of these aspects is a societal aspect that all of us have to work to, but obviously we as a department need to respond to the wave that comes our way. I will ask my colleague to speak to the medical male circumcision, the malnutrition, and the pneumonia questions, and I will just repeat for him. So the medical male circumcision, we can get the names of the NPOs for you, especially in the Central Kuru, we can get that for you. And then one of the comments that were made is that is there societal influence and stigma as one of the aspects. So perhaps he could respond to those for medical male circumcision.
Certainly. So I was thinking about the question, and just to remember what's at stake here is what you are trying to provide social marketing to encourage young men to submit themselves to a surgical procedure. All right. Now, firstly, think about how hard it is for most of us, myself included, just to make a GP appointment for a checkup when you're feeling fine. Okay, so you're feeling completely fine, but you know you should do a checkup, but you never get around to doing that checkup. So in the same vein, you're trying to convince tens of thousands of young men. Not only are they fine and everything's cool with them, but they need to go submit themselves to a surgical procedure. So there's a whole behavior change process that needs to happen. People might be interested, they might be aware, they might even agree, but actually getting them to the clinic on the day of the procedure is where we struggle. And we've instituted, or the NPOs have instituted, complicated follow-up processes. They'll go out in the community, they will encourage and bring in and promote the activity, they will get positive responses, but when the day comes for surgery to happen, the fall of rate has dropped by 50%, 90%. So just understand that is what is actually at stake here. It's easy to advertise, well, not so easy, but it's conceptually simple to advertise, very hard to get people to on the day of surgery. That's the struggle.
Can I just follow up on what you are saying? And is it more so in the metro than rural, or is it the same? The behavior is the same. And is there support groups for these patients to tap into, geestelijk beter in te stel om wel vir die prosedure te kan gaan, dat dat die ondersteuning groep is wat jou soort van aanhelp?
The short answer is I can't give you that detail because I'm not that close to or that familiar with the program, but I am aware that many of the NPOs that conduct the actual surgery have got an arm of community workers whose job it is to encourage and support after the surgical events and follow up. But I can't give you more detail than that, I'm afraid. But we can obviously find out.
Then there was a question on malnutrition. I'm just going to give it to you, and you could prepare, and then are you ready for that? So it was the malnutrition case for fatality rate, that was the one question. And the other one was, how is multi-morbidity measure, your question about diarrhea and malnutrition and TB and what's the correlation exactly, and so Dr. Pinard will answer that one.
Okay, so again, let me remind you what's at stake here. At the beginning of the year, we are asked to predict with single-digit accuracy how many children are going to die of X disease. Obviously, that's an impossibility. So in this particular example of severe acute malnutrition, we said 5 children, and it's at best an educated guess based on the previous year's statistics. Okay, we can't say, you know, how do we just know whether it's 5 or 7 or 15? So it's a difficult thing to predict. That's our so-called target. And then if we're wrong by one either side, if we say 5 and we get 6 or we get 4, we are by definition 20% off our target. So just to remind you that it's a bit artificial to be that concerned about the detail of a single number. You know, it's difficult, first of all. So just that's the context. So yeah, we said 5 SAM deaths. And so we are recording 10. But that is the second point. Children are resilient little creatures, and when children die, they're usually very, very sick. And it is very common for a child to both have pneumonia, well, often with the causative event is malnutrition or hunger. The child becomes malnourished, that results in an immune deficiency, that results in a pneumonia that comes on, or as you were saying earlier, prolonged diarrhea can result in malnutrition, which can predispose you. So children have, often when children are hospitalized and are sick, they actually have these multiple conditions at the same time. Very commonly diarrhea and pneumonia, and sometimes severe malnutrition at the same time. Previously, it would be the case that when a child died, you would assign one of those causes as the primary cause of death. We still assign that as the primary cause of death. But you can understand it's a bit of a bit of clinical judgment as to whether the child finally died of pneumonia or of diarrhea in a case of a very sick child. But here, what we're doing is when that death occurred and the child had severe diarrhea and severe pneumonia, we're putting them in each category. So there's an overlap here between the 10 children who died of severe acute pneumonia and the 43 children who died of pneumonia. It's actually an overlapping group. There'll be some children, some individuals are represented in both groups. So that partially explains so it's just the number thing and the multimorbidity thing. And obviously the difficulty in predicting with single-digit accuracy how many children are likely to die in a particular year. With regards to where those children die, most of them die in hospital. Obviously, they get referred up and up as they get sicker and sicker. But our early sort of preliminary investigations show that the deterrence is one of the hot spots, it seems. But if you wanted to generalize it, it is often in areas of poverty and migration with children who might be coming in without pre-existing immunization histories and that kind of thing. So I don't know if that explains.
Thank you, Dr. Pienaar. There was a question about, Honourable Member Lekker asked a question about the pneumonia case fatality rate on page 3 of the slides. The issue is that on page 3 we were still reporting on quarter 3 of last year. When you look at the annual report, you will notice that we have achieved the target, so it's different. And I think our discussion ultimately was only on the annual report, not only on quarter 3. And I think we'd just like to add the point that Dr. Pienaar has made. Very similar year, we have to predict with accuracy of one digit how many children will die of pneumonia, how many will we admit, and how many will die. So it's really a very difficult task. So in this particular last year, we had 6,800 children admitted with pneumonia, and of them, 45 died. So clearly, how do you predict that? And as you said, the multimorbidity is one of our key challenges. Moving on from that, there was a question about why do we give the reason of economic status as one of the contributing factors to poor performance. And it is important to recognize that in the higher your levels of deprivation is, those exact communities have a higher burden of disease. And their ability to be able to kind of sustain healthy living. So in terms of particularly in this case, it was about tuberculosis. And if a person with tuberculosis live in a setting with its overcrowding, it does have an impact. And very often there might be socioeconomic realities for that person to timelessly come back to the clinic, because these are TB is a chronic condition for 6 months of treatment, and the child has to, or the person has to come back. So that is the underlying, but it's not the reason. It is just of the realities that we recognize. And we've also, in the way that we look at targeting our health interventions, we do find that where you have the highest burden of disease, that is the same place we've got overcrowding, where there are high levels of deprivation, socioeconomic factors, all the upstream socioeconomic realities facing those communities. Then there were several questions, and Minister Bombo did go there in terms of bed occupancy rate and the list of hospitals. So you know, we can give those hospitals. What is important is that for a hospital, for example, Tigerberg Hospital, it's got 1,300 beds. Some of them are for children, some of them are only for eyes, some of them for maternity cases, etc. So you will find that in some wards for them, and at the moment they are about at 89% occupancy, that's high. For a tertiary setting, that's very high. So certain wards will be up to 130% full, whilst other wards m- might be less because, for example, eye cases, they usually go home over weekends, so you'll have a lower occupancy there. So it's difficult to kind of just look at the average, but we can give those, but how to interpret that. We do find that the metropole hospitals are largely affected by high bed occupancy rates. I mean, as Minister Mbombe has indicated, the higher it is, the reality is that we have to start looking at quality and patient experience because of that pressure. So it is an issue. So the question was also, so what is the plan? One response might be to build more hospitals. It's unfortunately not a health system's response. You'll have to find a way to understand why are patients coming to hospital, what is the burden so high that we can address that differently. And we do find that our chronic conditions, especially diabetes, hypertension, and kidney, all those three are chronic conditions that the one affects the others. Ultimately, you can go into kidney failure, renal dialysis, and all the others that follow from that. And diabetes have a direct effect on your heart, your cardiac system. It's got a direct effect on your circulatory system, etc. So to control diabetes, and we earlier spoke about cataracts, so it's so important to get that well controlled, that we try and prevent patients from coming in. And obviously, we previously also spoke about trauma and violence and motor vehicle accidents. So it is important that we look at the whole system strengthening. We've got evidence where we, by strengthening primary health care, we have reduced the number, the bed occupancy for children in all our rural hospitals and even in Red Cross Hospital. Diarrheal season was usually 140-150% full in Red Cross alone. Now they're much below 100%, largely because we strengthened primary health care. So it would not have been a wise thing to build a hospital with more beds for diarrhea. We have to focus on what are the prevention. That is the big strategy of the department. It's not to say that we don't need further hospitals, and as you know, Klipfontein Regional Hospital is on the cards. So clearly those things will happen, but unless we strengthen the health system and also move into the homes of people, we're not going to address the other aspects. Then there was a question on maternal mortality rate. I will have to find the page if my colleagues would just help me on that one, that we can just respond. The question was, what is the figure and how has that changed? I can indicate that as a province, page 11, I'm looking at this one. As a province, the province closest to us has doubled our figure in terms of maternal mortality. And what we found, and I think the comment here was, that we've actually reduced the maternal mortality rate, which is very positive. So a lot of the steps we take, a lot of the stuff we do is to reduce the number of women that die during pregnancy. That is your maternal mortality rate. And we do indicate it on that. So last it was 59 per 100,000, that is the definition, and now it's 57 per 100,000. And clearly also women who are pregnant also have diabetes and TB and HIV, and yet despite those burden of disease, we've been able to improve that, and I think that's very positive. So the details are in the document. Then there was an issue of slide 11. A change in the delivery rate for 11 to 19. So the National Department of Health decided to change the age period from 11 to 18, which was the one that is a high-risk group. That is evidenced by the high-risk women for the first child, but also pregnancy, and also their ability to care for the child. National Department extended that to 19, so we couldn't predict, we could set the target because the figures were not available at the time. So it's difficult to make a correlation. But what we did look at is to look at the Education Department, figures of the number of girls in school, the figures from the Education Department and clearly between health and education, social development, and whole of society, we need to assist women and young girls particularly to postpone their debut sexual experience, to be able to protect themselves and put themselves in a better scholastic position to go forward. Okay, let me just check. The ideal clinic determination, there was a question about that. So on the, in the pack of slides, the question was, have we reached all clinics? So it was a new indicator for the annual performance plan. And we did 268 clinics was our target, and we did 239. So our achievement is 89.2%. Those were the ones that were assessed for ideal clinic status. Now clearly, ultimately, we would like to achieve the ideal clinic status at the kind of, we're about 70%, but I wouldn't like to speculate on that one. So the question was, were all the clinics tested? We got to 89% of them that were assessed for ideal clinic status. Which, and I think what's important, as a province, we only started in 16-17 financial year. So this was only the second year of running the ideal clinic program in this province. So we are actually quite heartened by the number of activities, because it's quite, it's about, how many indicators? It's hundreds of indicators that you have to check for every clinic. I think the last time I had 800, but let me know. That, but it's really hundreds of indicators, and every indicator's got a range of data elements. So it's quite a hectic exercise, and I just want to put it out there.
Before you continue, Member McAlaney, I just so wanted to follow up on the response of the previous question just before this one. So I'm giving you an opportunity.
I just want to check: are follow-ups taken immediately after the response, or while withholding our follow-up until we receive all our responses? Okay, thank you.
So you want to follow up on yours?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then I'll give you Member McAlaney.
That's one of the things, Member. Now, after the explanation, I got more confused. I'm trying to understand. The one on page 11, on the delivery in 10 to 19, I'm trying to understand what was the change, and what is the change seek to do, or to solve, or to understand? I'm trying to understand what does the partially achieve mean to us in terms of servicing this age group.
I'll look to Leslie and Mike correct me, but the change was to change the definition of pregnant delivery from women 18 and younger to women 19 and younger. So obviously there's a whole lot more women getting pregnant. Obviously we consider younger than 18 and younger to be a young pregnancy, but for some reason we consider 19 and older to be a more, you know, a woman who can have a baby. So the change was that national suggested to count the number of teenage pregnancies, but sort of medically, we don't consider a person in their old teens to be the same risk as a person who's 14. You know, it's a totally different risk situation in terms of pregnancy. So I think the intention was to try and get a handle on the number of teenage pregnancies, but I think they're misconsidered, because I think 19 should never have been included. 19 is a healthy age to have a pregnancy. 13 is not.
What does partially not achieved mean, or partially achieved mean in this?
Well, the problem was that remember the new definition that changed from 18 to 19 came to us with about a week's notice before we had to print the book. And our past figures were only on the one on 0 to 80, or under 18, so that's the number we knew. So that number we knew, we had to predict now a new number, but we didn't take too much consideration into how much difference the additional year of 19 would make. If you're following me, I don't have the figures in front of me.
The key issue, Chair, is that it was a new indicator or a change in the definition of the indicator for which we didn't have the data to predict. So partially achieved, it is lower than 95% of what the target that we have set. But what is actually understandable because we didn't have any baseline to go by. Next year we'll be in a better position, but I fully agree with the Honourable Member. The logic of adding another year at the national level, that doesn't seem to make sense for the type of risk you wish to understand what's happening. But that was the national decision, and we're trying to comply with it.
I think it's easy to understand if you look at the actual numbers. So 8,000 women. So our target was 8,000 out of all the deliveries, which meant we thought that 8.7% of our pregnancies would be 18 years and yeah, well, this is a complicated thing. We're basing it on 18 years a number, and we thought that the number would be about 9%. But now if you add in the women that are 19 and pregnant, the number jumps from 9% of pregnancies to 11% of pregnancies. So there's a whole lot more women who are getting pregnant at the age of 19, and probably appropriately so, than the younger.
Thank you, Chair. The issue of the broadband, I will ask Dr. Valerie to respond to that one.
So the indicator on the broadband, as you know, this is a Western Cape government provincial priority to roll out broadband. So in our case, as far as health facilities go, primary healthcare facilities specifically, more than 90% of the facilities have received broadband rollout. I think we must draw a distinction between putting out the infrastructure for broadband rollout versus connectivity. Okay. And I think what members, honourable members, have alluded to, which we are aware of, and we've raised quite seriously with our CEI colleagues, is that connectivity is not the best at all times. And when it's down, it has quite a serious implication for services, like in clinics to pull out folders or that kind of thing. So we're quite aware of it. And beginning of this year, it's intended to be worse than previously. So we have raised that with CEI colleagues, and they are looking into that, and we've actually escalated the matter to our HOD levels to engage colleagues on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was a question also on the expenditure per PDE. The expenditure per patient day equivalent, that is what the PDE stands for. And that particular slide, is on slide 12, refers to expenditure per PDE in TB hospitals. And I'm just trying to quickly scroll my eyes where that is. Oh, here it is. That if one looks at the indicator, what is important is that we had less patient day equivalents in the hospital. That means there were less days than when the beds were full. But you still have the overhead costs, and you still have the fixed cost of the staff, and that led to a different achievement. I just want to see whether I've got the facts right. So here it says the actual expenditure was less than target because the patients were admitted for shorter days than expected. And the cost per patient day, so the cost per patient is higher. But because you've got less patients, it ultimately reduced your total expenditure per PDE. So it seems like a very complicated expenditure. But it's largely with the fact that we are trying to treat more patients in our communities. David, would you like to add to that? I think that's it, but it's the budget was the target was set for 1,056, and we spent 1,125 because of the overhead costs in the hospital. There were several questions on infrastructure, and the first question was how severe is it, and what's the implication of the 53 million underspending, and then also what is the problem and what are the solutions, and there's also a question on the relationship. I would just like to kind of preempt Dr. Angelique Toy's input. So between health and the Department of Public Works, we are putting a range of steps in to improve the relationship, because this committee has previously identified that as a particular challenge. We've identified that long ago. Between the two HODs, we've actually agreed that we will really make sure that we set the tone of a collaborative relationship, that we are in this as a partnership. What we are working towards now is to have a shared vision, is to say that health and public works must have the same vision to deliver buildings or infrastructure or maintain facilities for the better good of the public. And public works being a support service and not a line service, it's important for them to make that shift. So we are putting steps in place to improve the relationship. I do believe that it has improved. The capacity for performance, that remains one of the challenges, and give public works credit, they are looking at creative ways of addressing that. But the Honourable Member made the point that every year we've underspent. So apart from the year before this, the year 1617 was the first year that we actually overspent. But somehow things, it has not been possible to maintain that that performance. Dr. De Toy?
Thank you for the question. I was looking at the 53 million rand that is coming after the first year in 1617, where actually we had to break even. And the year before was 100 million rand of under expenditure. As the HOD mentioned, what is the problem? The problem is multi-facets. Infrastructure is a combination of action where the responsibility is under a lot of different stakeholders. Is transport public works, is health, is the service provider, professional, is the consultants, is the municipalities, some cases, and I will mention this reasoning, and I will attach two examples just to show you exactly what I mean. So it's a multifaceted kind of complex delivery process that each of the stakeholders needs to be able to perform in order for the end to have, so it's not one accountable at the end, it's a series of different stakeholders that we need to manage. The process, if you do remember, the IDMS, the Infrastructure Delivery Management System, is the process that we are following for infrastructure delivery. That is clear, clarify roles and responsibility, and you ask the question about relationship, and when you have clarity on roles and responsibility, actually you know exactly where is your sphere of intervention, where is your accountability, where is your responsibility. And with public works, that is our preferred implementing department or agent, they are responsible for all our capital infrastructure projects, as well as our scheduled maintenance projects. We, as health, we are responsible for, we call it the day-to-day and routine maintenance, as well as emergency maintenance. So that is the roles and responsibility that has been allocated through the umbrella of IDMS. Then there was the issue about capacity, and in 2012 the health department as well as education department went through a capacitation improvement process. As you know, we are using some funding from the national department in order to capacitate the infrastructure units as well as happening in education. Transport public works didn't have that kind of opportunity, and this is the reason why they were left behind in capacitation. In respect to the client component. What happened, and that is what Dr. Engelbert mentioned, Public Works last year went through they appointed a new chief director. For example, there was no chief director in health infrastructure that has been appointed from the 1st of November. They fill up the entire senior management component in that unit, as well as now they appoint what they call a capacity support company that is assisting them. They also feel a lot of post. So what as a way forward, we see that the capacity in public works is
is getting better. The relationship is getting better. We got a sign off service delivery agreement. As I said, the roles and responsibilities are clear. And we hope that this will move forward in such a way that the infrastructure delivery is going to improve quite dramatically in relation to capital and infrastructure scheduled maintenance. What else we are looking at? We are looking at the alternative procurement opportunity that are allowed in the sphere of IDMS, where they can actually reduce the time for the delivery of infrastructure. That is something that we are actually working together with Transport Public Works. But to go back to the 53 million rand of under expenditure, and I want to link to specific projects just to show you what are the case study and what are the reasoning for delays. One is Victoria Emergency Center. We put quite a lot of money last year because the project was about to go out to tender for construction. So if you look at our budget, there was a lot of money there because the project was supposed to go on tender. What happened is that the civil engineer, actually the structural engineer, decided to close down his office in Cape Town and relocated to Johannesburg. This means that the new structural engineer had to be appointed. And the structural engineer, as you know, doesn't take responsibility for the design that is on its own design. So we had to wait for the complete revision of the structural engineering design for the emergency center. It's a quite big project. It's a 72 million rand project. It's a completely new extension of the emergency center at Victoria Hospital. And this is why the project was delayed. And now the project is still not out to tender. It's going to tender hopefully at the end of August. That is was one project. Then we got Boosley. And as you know, Boosley is dragging along because the contractor doesn't have enough capacity. Last year with Transport Public Works, we looked at the possibility to cancel this contract, but at the end, the pros and cons in relation to cancellation was that it would be better to drag along the contractor, so hopefully it's going to be completed the project by December. It was supposed to be completed last year in September, so I'll just give you the time frame. It's the same project that Prince Alfred Hamlet was completed last year, but this contractor didn't perform for a lot of reasons, capacity and expectation from community and unskilled issues that were the outside. Falkenberg revitalization was another project that we put a lot of emphasis last year, but what happened, the entire consulting team underperformed, so Transport Public Works had to fire all of them. So the entire project now is standstill, and we need to completely start again the project with a new, fresh team of consultants. The consultants were not performing according to the adequate standard. Then there is George Tembaleto. George Tembaleto is a project but completed, but was delayed. When I say delayed, you have 12 months of cash flow for a project, but if you delay, of course you don't have the same expenditure in 12 months versus then the 15 months. So this is why the under expenditure in the financial year. So Tembaleto, what happened? The municipality delayed the connection with water and electricity. So you couldn't open or you couldn't complete the job unless you got water electricity at the facility. So there were a few months delay for the completion. And the last but not least is District 6. District 6 CDC was also 12 months delayed. The contractor was 6 months in penalty. But the reason is poor performance of contractor, drawings that were not given, so consultants were not giving the drawings to the contractor. So there were a lot of issues that dragged along the project until the completion of 12 months. And again, actually gave us an under expenditure for the financial year. So I'm just trying to make it simple and understand what are the reasons for under, but there are a lot of these. And I said, some of them are in our control, some of them are outside our control. But with Transport Public Works, as the HOD mentioned, we have a proper governance structure in place, we got the proper planning in place, we know exactly what we want to do in the next 10 years, in the next 10 today. Also, we work together with construction strategy, but there are other risks that, like those one I mentioned, can happen in infrastructure that can actually create some the issue related to infrastructure under expenditure. Thank you.
I know Member Leka is waiting to follow up on her response, but I just want to ask with your indulgence, Member Leka, with regards to this 53 million and the penalties that you say has been imposed on companies, would that penalties become rand value, become part of this 53 million?
It's actually the penalties, the way that they're applied is if I must give you 100 million or say 100 rand, but you are in penalty for say 20 rand per day and you got 2 days of delay, I will give you only 60 rand. You understand? So it's on the contract that is deducted the penalties amount.
Thank you. Dr. Engelbrecht, I can give Member Leka her opportunity to follow up on the response that you gave on her question. Member Leka.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, my question on the intent on the forensic pathology was, what other outreach programs are conducted by the department? And the response that I received indicated clearly that the department relies only on post-matric qualification. And if you Google indeed, you can see that one of the requirements is pure maths, English, and biology. Now, it makes me to deep chair to say clearly the problem is the product that the Western Cape gets from high schools, and that product is maths lit. So I want to propose to the department, I'm happy that the MSC is present here, to take this debate further of outreach, to go to schools that are still adamant in producing learners that are encouraged to take maths lit as a subject. Because once you get students that are not likely or interested to take this field, and once you get those that would have wanted to take this field, but the doors are closed for them because they've got B in pure maths, says a problem is not perhaps with the institutions of higher learning, but the problem is further down there. So I'm saying, Chair, part of the outreach programs that the department must undertake is also to engage the Department of Education. It might not be a Western Cape problem, the maths lit. It might be a national problem, but as a parent in Western Cape, I have a problem with maths. I'm going to make a two-sentence paragraph. I had a meeting with parents in Mitchell's Plain. I had a meeting with parents in Bonteville as well as Bella. Problem arises as a result of children encouraged a school to take maths lit as a problem. I'm not talking about our township, I'm referring to the so-called colored areas. I'm sure it's even worse in our township, Khayelitsha, Nyanga, Gugulethu. But the problem is there. The second part, Chair, which is direct to the department, or rather to the MEC, when I'm referring to the interns, I'm not referring to the pathologists. I know those are qualified doctors. I'm referring to the assistants. They are now forced to work a 12-hour shift. I've been to many post-mortems in my life, and the first person that deals with the body is your officer, the one that cuts the body from here up until the stomach. Those are the ones that are doing the major job, because they must cut that body and make it prepare and prepare it for the doctor to do the correct diagnosis. Yes, I'm not saying doctors are not doing much job. If a body has been shot with more than 12 rounds, that doctor will perform that one post-mortem for a day because they must do the correct diagnosis. But I'm saying, check, this intent would help the most those officers that are forced to work a 12-hour shift. If you must dissect 5 bodies a day, it's way too much. It's way too much. I've been there, I've seen it in with my own eyes, and I'm saying the issue of 12-hour shifts of those officers might be well addressed if we've got proper interns that will be trained and encouraged to continue or explore their career within that department. Because this is something that we must address. Perhaps for an ordinary person to see a dead person that has already been completed with everything is fine. But for those people who've been there since the Department of Health took over from the SAPS, they feel the burden that they have been dealing with for all these years. I'm saying, Che, let's look into this thing. It's a nice invention for the Western Cape, but it's going to be of much relief to those people. And if we can have more people, it means at the end of the day, we'll be able to address the issue of the backlog within these forensic centers. The last one, Che, which also I feel I did not get the response that I would have wanted. Perhaps we're getting a response to say, this is what you must get, and this is all we can give you. I'm saying, Che, when we were in that hospital, there was no electronic capturing of the data that they have. The doctor put it plain that they don't do it because they don't have enough staff. I know files must be kept for 5 years. That's a common knowledge for someone who's worked in the public sector like I did. Records must be kept for 5 years. But that electronic system that we so much boast is not there. Those people are not benefiting from this adventure, nice adventure that is there in other hospitals. I spoke to the doctor in charge there, and this is the answer that I received. So we must not be brushed with the responses. We must get proper responses as to when is that hospital going to implement and enjoy the fruits that every other hospital is enjoying currently. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Member Lecker. Member Mitchell.
Thank you, Chair. Excuse me. Chair, I want to latch on to Member Lecker's for lack of a better word, debate on this. Because I think it's important to firstly note, realize that, and while I agree with Member Laker, I don't, not all of us can be doctors, and not all of us can be forensic scientists, and. But I know that at the University of Stellenbosch, and I mentioned this before, they have this program called Schematas, right? And they then provide an opportunity for maths and science to be improved, and especially for learners that didn't get the education to get the marks in order to ultimately gain admission to might it be at school, but might it be to become a doctor or a forensic assistant and so. I said it previously in a committee, but how is the department going to, is there no sort of collaboration between the institutions to try and develop this kind of thing, so that students that are not able to get those high maths marks are afforded an opportunity? Because without getting into a debate, I was a product of a school where I had to fight for biology higher grade, for argument's sake, and I was one of three or four in my class. So we can't have this thinking that maths literacy and maths are automatically a choice for learners. There might just be maths literacy. Now, I know that it becomes an education thing, or education a problem, but I mean there's some sort of, there's just a missing link in this whole bigger scheme.
but by saying that, I also acknowledge not me, I'm not an Osika and doctor's face. Not as lucky as the minister.
I think there are about 10 categories of the health professionals that are working within the health system. You have starting from, for example, not necessarily in order of the importance, you've got the medical doctors, generally. I'm talking about now the standard 10 learner who wants to pursue in the health context, in the health professional. Because I think the confusion is about when Dr. B indicated about the meds, it's not about that. The province or anywhere else that you don't get the best students, but it's because they are spoiled to choices. So if you've got the best mathematics, you can do medical, you can do, but they more or less have more or less others, even like all of them that I'm counting, they need maths, not literacy. The medical doctors, the nurses, the physiotherapy, the pharmacists, the dental, the OTs, occupational therapists, and so forth, all of those. So about 10, all of them require maths. So it's not about, but the question is about the ones that are on your face are the ones that I've just mentioned. So people will have seen how the physiotherapist works, how the doctor works, how the nurse works. So now, for now to say, okay, now the other profession is about for you to dissect dead bodies. They haven't seen that. They don't even know that actually some of them. I was sitting here also listening to you. I didn't say that you were wasting our time.
Member Lekka?
So when we talk about that, because we do know in terms of the evidence, actually the medicine science in the Western Cape in terms of the production is higher, just like in any other, I think the other Luxury State in Gauteng. But the point we're trying to make, out of these 10 health professionals, they all require medicine science. So the pools that are going into these four universities are the same ones. But the question is about how do you now dangle a carrot for forensic instead of that child chooses to do whether nursing or physio or pharmacy and so forth. So it's not about that, there isn't much of that. So that is where we are. So hence now it's about that. Can the universities lower the grade in terms of the requirement for such? That one is an academic question, which is not our question. But for us, it's about create the environment. So I want to clarify that there are 10 health professionals working in our health system. All of their entries according to the academic qualification, they require mathematics. Not that about that, they are not. So that is the main point that I'm trying to raise. Thank you. And then the issue about how to go and attract, again, you need to also to look in terms of what is our role, what is the role of the academic institutions, because there are things that you cannot do without. Because, for example, we don't, unlike with EMS paramedics, where, we do have a college, where we have a college for nursing, in terms of that we have to be proactive and do that kind of the attracting the from our side. But we don't own medical schools. We don't own the teaching or whatever related to the FS. We don't. It's a role of the academic institutions. But for us, it's about how can we work together in terms to attract those kind of the things. Same as with the physiotherapy, whatever is done by the academic institutions. Only nursing and the ambulance stroke paramedics college that we own.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Minister has covered the issue on forensic pathology services. I take the passionate plea by the Honourable Member in terms of outreach to the schools. So we do outreach to say these are the profile of health careers that you can follow. As Minister has indicated, it's nursing, it's doctor, it's all of. So we do provide that scope of information and then indicate what subject choices to be made. I think what's important, what I hear also what the Honourable Member is saying, is very often we only target the grade 11s and 12s. By that time, you've long made your choices. And so perhaps we need to focus earlier in grade 9 where they make those choices. So I take that point. I think it's something that we can pick up, especially on this. I just also want to say that our target for forensic pathology assistant interns was 10. We achieved 9. So it's only one additional one that we should have reached, but I think the principle I take. Then the question about the electronic capturing, my apologies if we did not respond fully. So we have a few hospitals. It's only Khayelitsha, Mitchells Plain, one ward in Tygerberg Hospital that's got electronic content management. We don't have that in all our hospitals. So Friedendahl Hospital, like all the other places, you've got Clinicom, you've got those type of electronic systems, but it's not electronic capturing for patient records. And also the ECCR is kind of largely a discharge note. So perhaps it's important to understand it was Friedendahl Hospital that Arnold Menger was talking about, that we can follow it up just to understand what the doctor was mentioning. Because clearly electronic content management is a completely different exercise, and we, the department, has not yet taken a decision to roll that out because of the cost. And you still, in any case, you've got electronic, you still have to keep the hard copy file in any case. And so we have not taken a decision to roll that out across the whole department. Madam Chair, there was only one question on my list that I've not yet answered, and that was the mobility and mortality meeting in December at the Western Cape Rehab Centre that was not held. So the mobility mortality meetings is where clinicians and managers come together and they look at what has happened in the past month and then take decisions on, was it preventable, could we change the system, what did we learn from this, etc. Now, Western Cape Rehab Centre, the nature of the patient profile is that these patients very often go home over holidays. And so the value of and the number of morbidity and mortality cases would have been very little. So what they usually do, they pick it up the next month. So the learnings continue, the reflections continue, but this was just, the target was set for 12 meetings and they only achieved 11. And perhaps they should be more sharp in setting the target, because realistically speaking, 11 would suffice for the purpose. Thank you, Chair.
Member Kabida, I'll give you an opportunity now. I just want to come back to Member Lekker around the forensic pathology services. So these bursaries that were awarded was awarded to those already standing in that field or working in that field? Or is it totally attracting students to come into the field?
Thank you. So this was bursaries to attract interns, to get them into the system. Not all of them would feel that the work environment would suit them to go on to become assistants at offices. But this is just to make it attractive for people, to make it an option to select it. As the Minister said, if you've got maths, biology, science, your choices for careers is actually very wide. A forensic pathology assistant would not necessarily be your first choice. We try to make it attractive, but I've taken the points that were made.
Okay. And I think that the other part of Member Lekker's question is also those that are, as you mentioned, the shifts that they work, so those already doing the work, and those that are not pure maths, they don't have that entry requirement. So is there a bridge to bring them into a part of a formal qualification as indicated here? And I think that was the other part of the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there's two components to that question. The one is a 12-hour shift, and the one is how do we fill the gap? So the entry requirement for any person working in the forensic pathology space is as we've outlined. Historically, what we've inherited from SAPS were people that just by doing the job, they just got skills. And clearly there's a process by which we can assist them then to get the formal qualification. Because clearly the way that the occupational specific dispensation works is that unless you've got the qualification, you actually can't be awarded. Otherwise it's an irregular expenditure. So there is a process by which, now the first thing is, CPUT to conduct the training. CPUT will be the only higher education facility in the country offering the course. in this space. So we're actually very grateful that they're working with us on this matter. The other point is the 12-hour shift. What we find is that in all our emergency services outside of facilities, 12-hour shifts ultimately work the best because it's transport to and from, it's the way that the service is organized. So EMS and FPS are in that space. And they have to kind of reach out, they have to come in. So very often they have to work overtime because of the hours that they have to put in, but also that when the shift ends, they're still en route. So that is how we manage it. But in consultation with labor and the services and the staff, they ultimately feel that the 12-hour shifts work the best for them. Thanks.
Thank you, Member Cabido.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I think one of my questions also slipped off the table. Nobody's fault. My interest and focus is very much on this TB stroke HIV. And I think I posed a question around this responsive technological tool to be used to diagnose and engage with patients who are inflicted with this disease, TB, stroke, HIV, AIDS. And I just wanted to know, as I said, it's moving in the right direction. I'm extremely excited about it, tell you the honest truth. When will it be up and running?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Pienaar will respond to that.
Thank you, Member. Just to give you some context, the department screens and diagnoses, screens and tests hundreds of thousands of people for TB annually, and it diagnoses tens of thousands of people with TB annually, and about 45,000 people get onto TB treatment in the primary healthcare program annually. At the moment, the vast majority of those people are monitored through a paper system. And I'll explain the paper system to you because then you'll understand the other system. The paper system consists of a register held at the clinic where this treatment is being dispensed, TB treatment, and that register is filled in whenever the patient is seen, and that register is actually quadruplicate carbon copy register. And a page goes out every quarter and goes to a sub-district office, and that information gets captured in Tronic system there. What that means is that our ability to recognize that someone has started TB is always delayed by at least 3 months. Our ability to recognize it electronically is delayed by 3 months. We're moving to a system where instead of that register being held at the facility level, the information or the fact of registration and the fact of the monitoring will be recorded in a computer, that's linked to a server locally. So that means that we can recognize from the laboratory who has been, from a laboratory test who has been diagnosed or who has got TB, and we can recognize from this system who has started TB, because that's the other thing to understand. There's two kinds of, there's two of the challenges with regards to TB treatment are what we call initial loss to follow-up, that is the gap between someone who's diagnosed with TB laboratory-wise but never starts TB. That's called an initial loss to follow-up. And then there's a loss to follow-up while in care. So we expect that with people moving, or with this health system moving to this electronic information system, we're going to have a much better tag on the gap between initial loss to follow-up and also recognize much earlier those people who are lost to follow-up while in care. The other advantage is that currently we have a TB information system and an HIV information system. The system that we're rolling out is actually integrated and has capacity to monitor both of these diseases simultaneously. The rollout plan is we are hoping to have two sub-districts in the province fully digitized by the end of the financial year, and for the rest of the sub-districts, we will continue with the digitization in the same program, but not yet at facility level. That's the idea.
Thank you. You still want to follow?
Thanks, Chair. The Minister made mention earlier in the question that I've asked on the bed occupants of Khayelitsha and 130% occupants. And the question then further was, what is the department's plan? And the HOD said, we could say we are going to increase, but that is not a medical solution. Then it will go back to the question, and I'm sure the minister was expecting. Oh, she's gone. Okay, maybe the department will assist me. The minister has been to Khayelitsha Hospital several times where there's been a lot of coverage over the social media about what is happening with Khayelitsha. Starting from staff, equipment, everything. We've been to the hospital ourselves, and we find a beautiful hospital. But the story is not the same. And during last election, it was said it was electioneering, and that's why there was that much of a cry. But it seems now it's coming from internal in the main. Because some of the pictures are taken by staff members themselves complaining about the situation that is generally happening there. And it's such a beautiful hospital to be left to degenerate to what people are talking about right now. So I just need to find out what is going on there, if there is a plan. And maybe because, hey, I'm taking this opportunity now, I want to check if the HOD or the department can give me guarantees that they are fully in control of what is happening in the city clinics or city facilities in general.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So regarding Khayelitsha District Hospital, the Honourable Member is absolutely correct. It's really a beautiful hospital. I was there less than a week ago. And to be able to maintain that hospital 5 years after it's built in that condition really says about maintenance, about really caring for our infrastructure. The Honourable Member is also correct in terms of the pressure on especially our emergency centre and then also when we've got mentally ill patients. And very often it's more safe to have mentally ill patients, or they often choose to rather lie on the floor, which doesn't look well. So that is the reality. And what often happens is that the public or the staff, for whatever reason, would take a picture and circulate. And very often those same pictures, a month afterwards, the same pictures are recirculating, and they are recirculating. So somehow we find that the social media is used for particular purposes. But if you go into the facts, many of those patients that are seen there, they've already been assessed. They are perhaps waiting for a blood result. The diagnosis has been made. They're waiting for a bed. Actually, things are in control. Yet, we have to admit the hospital is full. And we are in the process. The psychiatric, we've just recently, I think 3 weeks ago, opened the 30-bed additional ward in Khayelitsha Hospital to be able to decongest and also to make space for psychiatric patients. The mental health burden in the province is really a big problem. So the reality in Khayelitsha Hospital is there. I've seen pictures of before and after when we established a collaborative approach between Tigerberg Hospital and Khayelitsha Hospital, where we now send specialists and registrars from Tigerberg Hospital to also rotate and work in the emergency center in Khayelitsha Hospital. And it has a massive impact for faster decision making, faster movement of the patient, get them to definitive treatment, etc. So it is important that we know that we've got large loads coming our way. We try to prevent that and strengthen our system as far as we can. Khayelitsha Hospital is one hospital in a bigger system. If the city clinics, and to come to the Honourable Member's further question, provide the full package of care, if we can contain patients better in terms of chronic conditions, because if you go to Khayelitsha Hospital, trauma is a big issue, the biggest burden is our chronic conditions, if we can get that properly managed. So clearly it's a systems response that we are looking at, and unfortunately there are people who find it could to distribute social media, even if it's old news, trying to foster negative connections. And we sat with the health facility board, and when we opened the we've got now a CT scanner in the Courage Hospital, we've got a 30-bed additional ward open there. And when I spoke to the health facility board, you know, they are in awe with what the hospital is doing, but somehow we're not getting the connection to the community. And there's a lot of activities now to make sure, can we have an open day for the community to come in, to have more community connectedness, to make sure that the clinic facility, the clinic committees, the health facility board are better connected, just to give that perspective. Because clearly what we've got in College Hospital is superior to elsewhere in the country. It's how we're not getting that message across. And if the Honourable Committee can help us with that, it will be really helpful just to kind of have a better and a more truthful experience. So it is an area that we are about. The other question, Honourable Chairperson, was about are we fully in control of city clinics? No, we're not. The city are rendering services according to their legislative framework. We transfer certain funding to the city, and we govern the outputs, whether they achieve the outputs as per the agreements that we've got with them. We've got the service level agreement in place, and we had a very good communication between our MEC and Alderman Smith on how do we take things forward. So we are positive that we will reach the point where there will be a more integrated approach and a full rendering of the package of care. But to answer the question, we're not in control, it's not our facility.
Dr. Engelbrecht, I'm glad that you say, because I was going to follow up with that question, what does the hospital board say, what is the report that you get from Khayelitsha Hospital versus what Member McAleni has just said is circulating on social media, and I'm glad that you allude to the hospital board and what the report is, but I then want to ask it differently. What is the report, the responses that you get from patients with their experiences at the Mitchells Plain Hospital?
Madam Chair, thank you. In general, for both hospitals, we find that the complements by far outstrip the complaints, that in those two hospitals particularly. The challenge with Mrs. Plain Hospital is they had a fire in the emergency centre. So we have received complaints of patients having the, because we've got a temporary emergency centre, and it takes time to rebuild at this. Dr. Angelides, we can perhaps give a bit more detail. But in terms of the quality of care, we really get such positive feedback. We yesterday had a session where we informed the Metro West colleagues about the Klipfontein Regional Hospital, what will be, where it will be, et cetera, et cetera. And I spoke to some of the clinicians and the staff there, and they say, of Mrs. Plain, and they say, what a wonderful place to work. And if your staff are happy, you'll find that your patients are happy as well. But we have to recognize it's full, patients wait, and that is our realities. But we really go the utmost space to make sure that staff got a good approach to patients, that we try to move away from agency staff, have permanent staff. So there's a lot of processes that we do put in place, that there's strong leadership, we've got stability in management, etc. So there's a lot of stuff that we do put in place. But clearly, we see 18 million contacts a year. Something somewhere will go wrong, we recognize that.
And then it comes back to what we have seen when we started this meeting this morning, that very often our focus will be on the what does not work part instead of what works. And is the department not then not highlighting enough of the good parts that happen? With departments, yes, we have the challenges, but we have the good stuff that happens, and we then, as a department, we do not highlight enough the good stuff that happens. And I mean, in terms of social media, the tool, yes, it is, you know, it's a quick spread of news. And there's a foul brand, so to say, in Afrikaans. So, yeah, and I think the department should highlight more
the good stuff that happens in all hospitals, not just, you know, in all medical facilities, not just in some stuff, so that we get a positive story on what is happening.
Thank you very much for that that observation, Madam Chair. I fully agree with you. For example, in Khayelitsha Hospital, we've got the lowest mortality rate of hospitals with that level of trauma. Yet, what is the narrative in the community? You go there to die. Mm-hmm. So somehow, whatever we put out there, the positive news doesn't give it. So it seems like there are people who make it their business to spread negative news. And also, you know, if you look at the media, they flourish on sensation. Mm-hmm. And good news is really not sensational. And we put out, and I must say, the Mandela Day coverage really did well, and we're grateful for the positiveness that came and could come across. And the Health Facility Board, I must say, Mr. Feeney in Khayelitsha Hospital is the most amazing person. What he is doing to really get the messages across, and that's why we're so excited about the Health Facility Board process and the clinic committees, etc., the progress that we are making. To be able to help us to speak the language of the community in such a way that there is that we are, the message is legitimate. Otherwise, it seems like you're just painting a rosy picture. But if there are any good ideas how we can do that, we are on Facebook. We've got our own Facebook page. We get positive message across. We've got about 6,000 followers. But you know, in a community of 6 million, 6,000 is not that many. So we're trying, clearly we have to communicate to our staff as well, and if our staff are advocates, that already helps a lot. And I must say, the one point that the committee did not pick up was that our entropy level, which is the reflection of the culture of the organization, has improved quite dramatically. And ultimately, if staff feel they work in a good environment, they would take that forward. And then one of the thank you, Chair, for inviting me to just speak about achievements. Just one achievement that is kind of hidden in all of this is that we've established 5 child death review boards. Now, clearly for the general public, you know, what does that mean? But from a health system perspective, from the perspective of our forensic pathology services, where a child would die, they go back and trace back, where did it come from, what happened, is there something in the system that could have been better, is there something that could have been done differently, or to what extent is there circumstances at the homes that is a risk to the rest of the siblings of that child. So clearly from a health system perspective, that is amazing. In the cervical cancer screening, we've exceeded our target. Our ambulance response times in rural areas is above target, the same in the metropolitan, despite all our challenges. Our TB co-infection rate, patients on ART is more than 90%, so there's a lot of good things happening. Somehow we find ourselves focusing on the negative stuff, and to get this positivity out there is, we just struggle, but we have to continue and make use of every possible opportunity. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Dr. Elbrecht and the team of the Health Department, and yeah, we have to encourage you to say this positive stuff, but also work on the negatives, yeah. But thank you for a very comprehensive report this morning, and thank you, members, for your interrogation into this report and for your responses to the questions that we have posed to you. We are now going to say goodbye to you. There is tea and coffee in the lobby as you get in, and to all our guests, and then as a committee we will just do our administrative duties. Thank you very much.
I'm checking with you any recommendations. Member Lekker?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I would like to request for a list of consultants that have been used on the construction of these clinics that have not delivered
and
as per
faulted.
Contractual contract. Yeah.
Okay, you got that, Simone? Okay, Member Makalini?
I wanted to recommend that we invite the Khayelitsha board. Simply because they are the representative of the community, and a lot is said, and that hospital is at risk, especially with what is currently happening in terms of land grabs and destroying of property. And there was a stage where people were ready to go and burn that hospital. Just to get a sense from them, what are they doing from the community in order to secure and keep that hospital standing.
Anybody else? Member
Gopi?
Sorry, Member
Gopi,
we got that.
Mine is on the recruitment of forensic psychologists. That the department must look at ways on how to really go out on the recruitment or to attract.
Sorry, Chair, can we add on that sentence, recruit and retain those that are on the system already? Thank you. I was also, Chair, can't remember the name of the doctor who is now at Fredendal Hospital, because she used to be here at Souls River Hospital. I was interested in knowing as to what prompted to the change from here to that side, and maybe we can get some money. I don't know. But it was something that I thought of.
Member Kibido, anything? Member Mitchell, anything? No?
Just a list of NPOs for the male circumcision. I don't know if everyone wants for the entire province,
yeah,
but
the
I want to know because the reason why I'm asking that, Chair, is because I know for a fact it doesn't happen in the central group. So I want to see if NPOs are being insourced or brought in, or that's actually the reasoning behind it.
Yeah, I also want to know because I don't know how they get the clients, patients.
Yeah.
On the West Coast. I've never heard of any NGO working in that space. So.
Chair, I don't know whether this is going to be a recommendation or a request or what, but it's actually a difficult thing for me to. The parents bringing their infants and their babies and what for scans and for treatment and for whatever the case may be. And now they attend the hospital, they present themselves, come for care, medical care and assistance, then they leave. But now with the tracking down of these people and the tracing, they say that's a problem. Without fixed domicilium, no fixed addresses, etc. I want to know how many cases, but in the financial year 2016-17, in the reporting period, did they encounter, because that is a serious problem. Non-traceable patients, and especially as far as addresses are, which addresses are they giving to the hospital? And now they are moving, are they not informing the hospital that about the change of address? And the other issue is, if one is ill or terminally ill or just very critically ill, to stay away from a follow-up, I mean, there is a risky thing to do.
Okay, thank you.
he needs help. So I don't know how we're going to phrase it, but perhaps your head is much better than mine.
I'm also just thinking, Member Lekker, you want to support us here, and how do we phrase this?
How many untraceable patients, because of lack of fixed addresses or contact numbers, did you experience in this reporting period?
And maybe what is the role of the
in terms of health, defaulting on the medical service they require?
And what is the role
of
the medical
workers
in this case?
Tracing.
When I was in that area, we had one of those responsibilities to train those people who are no longer coming to
what measures do they put in place?
Namonde, did you now get all of that and made sense of what we all have said now? Just read that back to us, just that one.
And then Member Lekker's point also, what measures are in place? What is the role of health workers to trace these patients?
Okay, thank you. Okay, now we're going on to minutes. You have the minutes of the 22nd of May in front
just
of you.
Just one thing, Chair, before we do. You know, Chair, when we are in the chambers, we succumb to the abuse of the MECs. Instead of reporting in Cape Town, they go via Simonstown, Helderberg, West Coast, and come back to Cape Town, if they do come to Cape Town. And I find it very disturbing for the MEC to volunteer herself and respond not even to the question, but something that is irrelevant. To the West, the answers comes from the HOD. Instead of her coming with those answers, she goes all over. I don't think it's acceptable. We accept it there because there are certain roles and the speaker is the alpha and omega. But yeah, we're here for answers, Chair. I don't think I'll be sitting in a meeting again where there is MEC Mbombo who will not respond to the question but continues to speak her own thingy, which is not even relevant to what we are talking about. I've noted with the first response, again when I responded, she again went all over the town. I hate it with a passion, Chair.
I hear you, Member Lekker, but I also want to say that in what has happened, I think that you should have given her an opportunity to finish what she has said and then not have this dialogue of a disagreement in front of the department, and I think we have spoken this about this before, and you should have allowed her, the minister, to have finished what she has said and then raised and said, Chair, can I follow up? And with that saying, Chair, in terms of what the response was of the minister, that is not the response that I
would have wanted. I think I need to rephrase my question. Here is my question. But not have gone into this difference dialogue.
Chair, I hear what you're saying. What you're saying is a matter of a procedure. But how do you begin to raise a procedure on top of somebody who continues to go AWOL? Because the first question she answered in her own way, with her own perception. And with my follow-up, I said, this was not responded to adequately. And this is what I'm asking. And I further made a kind of interdepartmental engagement. But again, Chair, she said the same things over and over. So where do you draw the line? Because it's a continuation of whatever. It's like, I'm going to say whatever I want to say because I think you don't understand. And of which with the second response, I understood and I made them to understand. I've been to all postmortem, and my question was never on the pathologist, but it was on the officers from the beginning. It spoke about the intent, and I made it clearer with the second. I said the officers. Maybe that part was not clear. But we continue to get this abuse. It's unacceptable, Chair.
I hear what you're saying, and I think I guided it then to say, I think this is what you wanted to know, which Dr. Engelbrecht then responded to, and I think she responded to the actual question that you have had. Member Makaleni, I know too.
Chair, I was also going to say, then it needs you to assist in guiding the direction of the debate. Because really, if she goes and talk about everything else that's not the response that is required, then when every time we have to do a follow-up, because sometimes I let my question go because I feel I'm not getting to what I need to get to. And at the end of the day, we're going to complain about time. So, Chair, if we can stick to the questions and then we can get the response towards the question.
I know what you say, yeah, and I'll take your guidance in going forward. Okay, can we get back to the minutes, 22nd May? There's a page 1 and a page 2. Then there's a page 3. And then there's a page 4. Just ensure on page 1 also that you were here, if you said you were here, and that your presence is noted accordingly. Can I have a mover and a shaker? No, but that is attendance.
Oh, it's attendance.
It's attendance, yeah.
It's attendance.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. All right. Member Mitchell has... can I have a seconder for Member Mitchell? Member Gopi, thank you. Then we have a draft report of the visit to the Salt River Mortuary dated 8 May.
Actually,
are you moving?
Yeah,
okay, thank you. And a seconder? Member Gopi or Member Mitchell? Thank you. Thank you, Member.
Lekker.
Not in the minutes necessary that I'm thinking before you close.
Oh,
we're
not close.
Okay.
Okay, I'll give you an opportunity before we. Swartland District Hospital, dated the 12th of June. Page 2 is of significance to us. Page 3 as well. Page 4. Can I ask for a proposal, Member Gopi, and a seconder? Member Mitchell. Now, in terms of other matters in front of this committee, you have received that invitation to the Neighbours Farm event, dated the 16th of August. Now, according to the notes that I have, myself and Member Lekker has confirmed attendance. Members, any other member that would want to go, that we need confirmation now. This neighbor farm.
I was not sure if we have a sitting on Thursday or not.
So Thursday the 16th, we do not have a sitting.
Okay.
We have the next sitting is on the 23rd.
Okay.
The
so
next sitting
I'm available.
No. Just in terms of me, I have some issues in my constituency that I have to attend to. But I will phone the lady in question and just explain to her that I might not be able to attend. Okay? But is Member Lekker, you're still okay to attend, and Member Gopi?
Yes.
Members, Kavido,
no,
Member Mitchell?
No.
Okay. Are you confirming now, Member Kavido?
No, I'm traveling by I'm going.
Member Mitchell? Okay. You have Member Lekker? Member Gopi, Member Kavido. Now, the committee has also been invited to a domestic violence roundtable discussion by the Institute for Security Studies and the Hans Seidel Foundation on the 11th of September. So that's time. And now we need to, when do we need to confirm our attendance?
By one
country by 1 September. Okay.
September.
So please think around that so that we can. Have you confirmed already?
No, I'm just confirming.
You're confirming now. Okay, Member Lekker's confirming. Okay, it's the 11th of September. Just check your phone. It's on a Tuesday. What is on our...
And the round table is what time?
At 11 to 1.
At 11 to 1.